sorry. And so then after that, I'm going to discuss how we are prioritising our efforts and our funding, and if that's in line with the evidence and in line with international and regional recommendations. So before we start, I want you to think about the last 7 days. So who here, please put up your hand, has done at least half an hour of moderate or vigorous intensity exercise, such as walking, brisk walking or a sport, on 5 or more days of the week? Put up your hand. Well, put up your hand if you haven't. And the rest of you can't remember. So I think this is a slightly biased audience. I think we've got round about 75% have, but that's a little atypical for the population, as we'll find out. So what do we mean by global pandemic of physical inactivity? The epidemiologists tell us that physical inactivity is the fourth leading risk factor for global mortality after high blood pressure, smoking, and high blood glucose. So what does that mean? Lee, who's an epidemiologist, has recently done some analyses that were published in The Lancet this year, and she's calculated that physical inactivity accounts for between 6 and 10% of all deaths globally. Now, I put a comparison here with smoking down below, and she actually says that it's about the same as smoking in terms of the mortality burden. Because although smoking is a bigger risk factor, as you can see here, the hazard ratio, or the risk of, if you smoke, of early mortality is higher than physical inactivity, there actually the prevalence of inactivity globally is higher than the prevalence of smoking. So it's around about 30 to 35% globally of adults are not sufficiently active for health benefit. So that's why it's a pandemic. That's more than a third. So they've calculated the population attributable risk is around about 9% for physical inactivity contributing to mortality, and perhaps responsible or associated with around about 5 million deaths per year. So physical inactivity contributes to a number of conditions. We know it contributes to cardiorespiratory diseases such as heart disease, stroke, metabolic conditions such as diabetes and obesity. It contributes to musculoskeletal conditions such as osteoporosis and osteoarthritis. If you are physically active, you're less likely to develop osteoporosis. You're less likely to develop osteoarthritis. Cancer, there's an association with an increased risk if you're physically inactive, particularly with breast cancer and colon cancer, but other cancers too. Physical inactivity is associated with functional decline and falls in the elderly, and also in depression. Now, this association with depression is probably bidirectional, because people who are inactive are a little more likely to develop depression, but those who are depressed are less likely to be active. So it's a bit difficult to work out cause and effect. Looking globally, and you can see New Zealand is down here, so way down there in the Pacific. But this is the global rates of physical inactivity, where it's been measured around the world. And this varies, insufficient physical activity for health benefit. It varies from less than 20%, particularly in areas that are still rurally based and less developed, to over 60% in some more developed countries. But it actually doesn't always follow that relationship. And there are some countries, such as the UK, that has very high rates of physical inactivity. And what do we mean by that? They've used the definition of less than 5 times of 30 minutes of at least moderate intensity physical activity per week, or less than 3 times 20 minutes of vigorous activity per week. So Canada, 30 to 40%, same as New Zealand, 30 to 40% are insufficiently inactive, insufficiently active. The states, between 40 and 50%. There are other trends around the world. We tend to get less active as we get older. Men, on average, tend to be a little more active than women. It's also correlated with education. More educated people tend to be more active. It's the same with socioeconomic status. There are even differences in different ethnic groups on average. These are US statistics. Also, these are stats from 2001 and 2005 showing very little difference over time. Things have been fairly static. but we've known about the association for a very long time. So let's talk about some definitions, and I know there are experts in this room who know a lot better than I, and there are a variety of definitions of these terms, like physical activity and exercise in the recommendations. But in terms of a working definition, physical activity is basically any bodily movement produced by skeletal muscle that requires energy expenditure. And exercise tends to be a subset of that. So it tends to be more planned, more repetitive physical activity, and often done for the purpose of physical fitness. We use, and I'm guilty of this, these terms interchangeably, often to communicate our message more clearly. So what is recommended? We've already mentioned 30 minutes of moderate intensity physical activity on at least five days of the week. This started around about 1996, perhaps earlier, when the US Surgeon General's report came out summarising the existing evidence for health benefit of physical activity. And this seemed to be a bit of a cut point where big health improvements were seen with this level of physical activity. But there are some health outcomes that require about double that, and things like risk of cancer are associated with more than this level. Also, things like weight loss do require more than the recommended level. So this is like minimum recommended. However, there are benefits seen with much smaller amounts of physical activity. For example, in the sedentary older age group, if they're doing nothing and they start doing a little bit, you'll see benefits such as improved balance and function in older adults, for example. There are a lot of other examples where health benefit starts before this level of 2.5 hours a week. The health benefit that you get from physical activity depends on a few other things as well. It depends on the fitness of the person. So basically, if you go from a sedentary status to a little bit active, you're getting more relative benefit than if you're already active and you become even more active. And I'll show you some examples of that. It varies by intensity. I've already mentioned moderate, vigorous. Moderate intensity activity tends to be something like brisk walking, where you are still able to hold a conversation, but perhaps you're not able to sing. You're not sweating, you might be a little bit puffed, but it's not vigorous intensity, which is more associated with puffing, and you definitely can't sing or talk when you're doing vigorous intensity activity. It depends on the type or the duration that you're doing it. Are you doing it for 30 minutes of a day, an hour? Are you doing it for 10 minutes? And how often are you doing it? These things also do influence the health benefit. The type of exercise influences what sort of benefit, if it's resistance, if it's aerobic, what muscle groups, what joints are involved in the exercise will depend on what sort of benefit accrues. The length of training, have you just started doing exercise or physical activity last week, or have you been doing it for 6 weeks, or have you been doing it all your life? There's usually a dose-response relationship between exercise or physical activity and health benefit. Not always, but usually there is. So some is good, more is better. It's not always a linear relationship, and I'll show you what I mean. This is the graph of dose response association between physical activity levels of leisure time activity and or relative risk of all-cause mortality. So someone who's not active at all, their risk starts at one. If they start doing an hour and a half, their risk reduces by 20%. 2.5 hours, it's 20 to 30% relative risk reduction of mortality. If you want to get another 20 to 30%, you have to do more than 7 hours a week of the same intensity activity. So the maximum benefit happens from sedentary to a little bit of activity, and that's why they chose this target, because that's when the majority of the benefit happens for a population. So just a little bit of a summary of the epidemiological evidence for associations between physical activity levels and health outcomes. These are passive observational studies of large cohort studies, tens or even hundreds of thousands of people over time. They've seen that people who tend to do the recommended levels of physical activity have a reduction in all-cause mortality of 20 to 30%, cardiovascular mortality, cardiovascular endpoints like heart disease, stroke, colon cancer, breast cancer, even lung, endometrial and ovarian cancer have a reduced risk. Depression we talked about as well. Type 2 diabetes, there's some pretty good evidence, both experimental and observational, that it reduces your risk by between 40 and 60%. But that's a dose response as well. It improves with more activity. It's also not only duration but intensity. There are some very large studies that have shown, like in the nurses' health study, cohort study, about 70,000 nurses followed over time, that it's not only the amount that they walked every week, but it was the speed that they walked every week was associated with reduced risk of both stroke and heart disease. Osteoporotic fracture as well, those who are active are less likely to experience a fracture. Now, there was, as I mentioned before, this year in July, there was a Lancet issue that was pretty well dedicated to physical inactivity issues around public health. And Harold Cole, in his article, said that we need to be systematic in our approach. We need to be intersectorial. We need to have all sectors involved. We need to attack this issue of the pandemic of physical activity, which was his, I think he was one of the first to use that term. We need to address this issue at an individual, social, cultural, and environmental level. And he particularly focused on the low-income countries, which are going from states of undernutrition to obesity, from active rural to sedentary urban, and this is a growing problem. So there are a number of international organisations who are involved and who are making consensus statements and recommendations and asking member states to sign up. For example, the WHO in 2004 brought out the Global Strategy on Diet, Physical Activity and Health, and they followed that up with the WHO Non-Communicable Diseases, or NCDs, Action Plan in 2008. So they are asking their member states to develop policy around transport policies to promote active commuting, such as walking and cycling, urban planning that promotes space for recreational activity, fostering intersectorial collaborations for physical activity promotion, and also surveillance of population physical activity levels over time. Another one is the International Society for Physical Activity and Health. They brought out the Toronto Charter in 2009 for physical activity, the Global Advocates for Physical Activity. So again, very similar recommendations. They have over 70 countries that have been signing up for this, or members from those countries. Evidence-based strategies addressing, again, environmental, social, and individual determinants of physical inactivity. Equitable approaches to reduce disparities, using cultural sensitivity, sustaining partnerships at all level, building capacity and support for research, practice, policy, evaluation, surveillance, using a life course approach, making healthy choices, easy choices, and importantly, advocating to decision makers and communities. Another one, specifically in the medical field, is Exercise is Medicine, another organisation brought out, I think, in about 2007 by the American Medical Association, the American College of Sports Medicine. Their logo is calling on all health providers to assess, review, and review every patient's physical activity program at every visit. I don't think you have us family physicians doing that every time, but we'll certainly, we need to be making more of an effort. So they brought out a charter in 2010 as well. And then there's the United Nations. Last year, the NCDs, or Non-Communicable Diseases Committee, met, and they brought out recommendations to their member states to focus on and develop policy around lifestyle interventions, including physical activity recommendations, policies, and at every level to address the non-communicable diseases issue, which now accounts for more than 60% of global deaths. So that's cardiovascular diseases, cancers, chronic respiratory diseases, and diabetes, which has overtaken infectious diseases as the major cause of death. At a regional level, there is growing evidence and growing number of initiatives that show that adult and child physical activity levels are influenced by our environment and our surroundings. Bowman has summarised the evidence in the latest Lancet and said that urban and regional planning in terms of street connectivity, walkability, safe streets, lower speeds and volume of traffic, proximity of recreational areas, proximity of shops, the aesthetics of an area, the bike paths, good public transport systems, and sports and recreational programs, all are associated with increased adult and child physical activity levels in a community. So I want to hone down now to talk about the healthcare setting. I'm not going to talk about education or workplace setting, etc., but those are very important as well. But being a family physician and a clinician, let's talk about healthcare setting. Now, I put up this over 500-page e-book from the Swedish National Centre for Physical Activity and Public Health, because I think it's a fantastic book. It's been introduced to me relatively recently. It talks about the ways and evidence for the treatment and prevention of 33 different groups of conditions using physical activity as a treatment or prevention. They summarise the experimental evidence for it, and they summarise what type of exercises should be advised or prescribed for your patients. So I think it's a great resource to use, but it also shows you the breadth of effect of physical activity. And one of my favourite examples is exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation following heart attack, or MI, myocardial infarction. So those who've already had a heart attack, exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation has been tested in randomised control trials, a number of those, and analysed in terms of a meta-analysis. And they found that exercise-based cardiac rehab reduced the odds of a repeat MI, repeat heart attack, by 47%. So it basically halves risk. It reduces fatal MI by 37% and all-cause mortality by 26%. You might think, oh, okay, that's pretty good. But actually, this is just as good as pharmaceutical interventions, if not better. If you compare that with statins, cholesterol-lowering medications, the latest meta-analysis, or a recent one, showed very similar statistics. So exercise-based cardiac rehab is as good, if not better, in terms of effectiveness. And this is experimental, not observational now. These are randomized controlled trials. So how does it do it? How does physical activity improve cardiovascular health? Well, it improves it in people who haven't yet had a heart attack as well, and just everyday people. It's preventatively. It lowers blood pressure 3/2 across, say, a population of what we call normotensive, or people without high blood pressure with not particularly good long-term adherence. If you closely monitor people with their activity, a moderate physical activity, which exercise-based cardiac rehab is based on, can lower blood pressure by about 7/5 in those with high blood pressure, about the same as a antihypertensive, but it's doing an awful lot more. It improves lipids, particularly around triglycerides, but also physical activity has a whole raft of effects on the cardiovascular system. Cardiorespiratory fitness, cardiac muscle size, and the efficiency of contraction. It makes oxygen use out of the blood more efficient. It even improves microvascular development, so you improve the blood supply to the heart and elsewhere. It helps to make your peripheral vascular system more responsive to changes, and it also helps with platelet clotting, especially it impairs the clotting of platelets in moderate intensity physical activity. It can actually enhance clotting in vigorous activity, particularly in people who aren't trained, but on the whole it reduces risk of clotting. It reduces arterial stiffness and actually impairs, and some evidence to say that it reduces atherosclerosis as well, or clogging of the arteries. So management of type 2 diabetes, another area where I do quite a bit of research, and exercise improves glucose control. So it reduces HbA1c, or glycated hemoglobin, by around 0.6 to 0.9%. These are from big trials and meta-analyses. So if it was a drug, it probably would be approved by the FDA, particularly for its low cost and safety profile, because they do tend to approve drugs that reduce it by about 1%. So exercise and diet also prevents diabetes, and this has been shown in a pre-diabetic population 3 times in 3 very large, in fact 4 large trials based in the 1970s up to the late 1990s and early 2000s. In Finland in the Malmo trial, in China in the Dajing trial, and in the States in the DPP, or Diabetes Prevention Program trial, they used exercise and diet, so it's a lifestyle intervention, and they compared that with medication and placebo, and found that for those who were at very high risk of diabetes, it reduced the progression to diabetes by about 50 to 60%, and was even better than medication, metformin, which is a diabetes or sugar lowering medication. You might think, well, that's probably the diet, but actually the Dajing Chinese trial had a physical activity only, and that was just as effective, if not slightly more, than the other diet only or combined arms. So a number of cost-effectiveness studies have been done on this particular intervention, and they've modelled how what sort of benefit it would be long-term. It's very cost-effective, and it could really cut healthcare costs from a national point of view as well. This is a Canadian graph. However, this has not been taken into practice, because, and I think it's partly because it's a very expensive intervention. It was $2,000 per person in the DPP trial, so it tends to put policymakers and health funders off. But if you look at the cost effectiveness, it's actually still very cost effective. There are a lot of other conditions. I won't go into it. Osteo and rheumatoid arthritis, there's been a number of trials that show that it improves function and pain without increasing adverse effects. This is moderate intensity physical activity. Osteoporosis, it increases in experimental design trials, improves bone mineral density, and there's actually at least one trial that's shown a reduction in vertebral fracture. A risk of falls, physical activity improves balance, fitness, and muscle strength. I've been involved in some of these falls prevention trials, so exercise is very effective in reducing falls in older people. A number of other conditions, depression, anxiety, sleep, quality of life, immune response, cognitive and physical function, and dementia. There's just been some trials published just very recently that shows that. So basically, everything that gets worse when you grow older gets better when you exercise. There are hazards too, particularly around vigorous physical activity. It can increase your risk of injury, for example, particularly when there are hazards involved or contact sports. For moderate intensity physical activity, there's usually minor musculoskeletal injuries or falls, particularly in those who are frail or untrained, but they tend to be much less likely. And overall, particularly in moderate exercise or moderate physical activity, the benefits outweigh the adverse effects. Now, I want to look a bit more about the healthcare setting and family practice specifically. So, look, a little bit of just setting the scene. In Canada, adults attend their family physician on average about 3 times a year. And those who are most sedentary or those who already have a chronic condition or at risk of a chronic condition tend to attend even more often, and they're the ones who are going to benefit most from an exercise program or some physical activity. People expect to receive health advice from their doctor or from their health professional, and they have high levels of trust in the advice, so you'd think it would be an ideal place to promote physical activity. Well, we haven't done a very good job. And part of us, we just don't know how to do it. So we wanted to work out what is the most effective way, in a brief consultation of 10 to 15 minutes with an agenda of other things to address, to actually increase physical activity. So there have been a number of interventions developed, a number have been trialled in family practice, been several meta-analyses looking at the trials and the evidence, trying to find out what things predict what's going to work and what's not going to work. There was one meta-analysis by Eden, and she suggested that behavioural approaches, patient goal setting, written exercise prescription, individually tailored exercise, and follow-up by trained staff made a difference and optimised your outcome. So in the during the 1990s, I think it was in the UK that they first developed the exercise on prescription. In New Zealand, we copied it, of course, and we called it the green prescription, and we tailored it a little bit. Basically, it involves the family physician or our primary care nurses giving very brief advice to increase physical activity using behavioural techniques, motivational interviewing techniques, or trans-theoretical theory, so you get the patient engaged in the whole process and work out their readiness to change, and then tailor your discussion and consensus of goal setting on the basis of that. So then the goals are written on a prescription, and the prescription is given to the patient and also faxed to an exercise facilitator in the community. Now, we in New Zealand have regional sports trusts throughout the country, and exercise facilitators are based at those trusts. So they then provide telephone support just about once a month for about 3 months, and they mail out newsletters and they send out fridge magnets, and they work out what would be appropriate for that person, what resources are available and easy to use for that person. We started trialling it in 1998, and it was rolled out nationally around about 2000. And it's been going since then. Nationwide. So what are the things that we recommend in our green script? Well, there's been a few surveys, and the most of these activities are that are recommended are home-based or easy for the person to do. So the walking is by far the most commonly recommended activity. But depending on what the person chooses or thinks is achievable and sustainable, it might be gym exercises, it might be swimming, it might be cycling, it might be some home-based exercise programs or group programs. So when is it used? Well, doctors or family physicians, we call them GPs in New Zealand, they tend to choose to use the green prescription brief intervention when there's weight issues, although as you've seen, it often takes about double the amount of physical activity to reduce weight. But it also in terms of high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, arthritis, etc. So you're using it in a broad range of conditions and also for prevention. So when it was being rolled out, we thought, as a skeptical GP at the time, I thought it'd be a good idea to do a randomised controlled trial to see actually how effective it was and whether this really was going to work. So we did a cluster randomised controlled trial between 2000 and 2003 when it was being rolled out. And we enrolled consecutive adult patients attending each practice over just under a week period of less active 40 to 80-year-olds using a screening question in the waiting room. We invited all of the urban and rural family practices to participate in the Waikato region, where I was a rural GP at the time, which is around about there, in the middle of the North Island. And we then followed up their physical activity levels. We looked at a couple of other things, quality of life, blood pressure, adverse events, and we also did a cost effectiveness analysis. So this is the question we used. As a rule, pretty similar to the one I used before, do you do at least half an hour of moderate or vigorous exercise, such as walking or a sport, on 5 or more days of the week? We used exercise because we trialled it out with physical activity and we got completely different answers. This one correlates relatively well. It's sensitive, it's not particularly specific, but if you say no to this, you probably are not doing the amount. So we had about 3/4 of the family physicians in the region said, yes, that's fine. So we had 42 practices, 117 family physicians. We screened just under 3,000 adult consecutive patients, and 45% were insufficiently active according to that screening question. And 2/3 who were screened as less active agreed to participate, so 878, and 85% of them completed the 12-month research follow-up as well. So just looking at the baseline characteristics of the study population, you can see that over 90% of those who were screened as inactive had at least one cardiovascular risk factor. So screening for physical inactivity is highly correlated for high risk of chronic disease. So what happened? Over the 12-month period, we assessed them more accurately with a longer validated physical activity questionnaire, which we'd also, in a subgroup, tested against pedometers, and found that around about 20% at baseline were achieving in some part of their life 2.5 hours of physical activity per week over the year, of at least moderate. Over the year, both groups actually increased, but the intervention group who got the brief intervention at the beginning, at 12 months they'd increased significantly more than in the control group. But the incremental difference was quite small. It was less than 10% incremental difference in the proportion achieving the recommended levels. So we then calculated the number needed to treat, the NNT. So basically that means that you have to give about 10 green prescriptions to have one person achieve and sustain the recommended physical activity levels for at least 12 months who otherwise wouldn't have done that. So you think, oh, that's not very good, but actually it's a very cheap intervention and it's a very brief intervention. So it works out pretty good. This is some other outcomes. This is just mean physical activity levels per week of leisure time, and there was a difference of an average of 34 minutes. Change in blood pressure. We had a significant drop in blood pressure in the intervention group, but not in the control group. But the difference between the groups didn't quite reach significance. A small amount, but across a population with a 10% adherence is not bad. Quality of life. We had improvements in about 4 parameters of quality of life, and we had no significant increase in falls or injuries. So we collected some cost data. We looked at the direct and indirect costs of the program, and the participant costs, the healthcare provider costs, and some of the offset costs as well, time off work, lost productivity, and other health providers as well. And we calculated the program cost per participant around about New Zealand dollars, or a little less value than Canadian, but around about $170 New Zealand. Now that meant, because only 1 in 10, remember, incremental difference over time, that to make one person who was sedentary active, it was about $1,700. I'll talk a bit more about that costing later, but just remember that. We also did some qualitative research and looked at the barriers and enablers. The usual suspects: lack of time, other health and psychological limitations, bad weather, unsuitable local environment, lack of sidewalks, places to walk, etc. Other enablers, there was the commitment, guilt, significant others, so support came up a lot. A social interaction, doing a walk with a friend, or having some sort of interaction with your partner, or even taking a dog for a walk. And the commitment or contract made to others, if you knew that your facilitator was going to ring you, that helped to keep you motivated. So how are we going to make this more effective than what we had, and help our patients to understand it's simple, but it's important? So we did do a bit of tweaking, and I was lucky that a women's research group in Wellington wanted to do some research in this area, so I worked with them. We tweaked the green script a little bit on the basis of our findings, and we wanted to see how long it lasted over 2 years. So this is a 2-year randomised control trial between 2005 and 2008. It's nationwide already, so the control group could have got a green script in their usual care, but we systematically gave the other group a green prescription from a primary care nurse this time. So 17 practices, similar outcomes, but follow up for 2 years. The intervention involved family practice nurses giving the advice and a script, the green script. Exercise facilitators kept up the support for a bit longer, on average 5 calls over 9 months, and there was a second face-to-face with the primary care nurse at 6 months. Again, motivational interviewing, similar sort of activities were prescribed or advised. So at baseline, on a closer examination, there was about 10% who were active over 12 months. You can see both groups, again, participating in this sort of trial does tend to motivate people to become more active. But there was still a significant difference between the groups at 12 months, less of a difference at 24 months. We had, again, similar improvements in quality of life parameters, but not all. There was one that went down. We had a significantly increased risk of falls and injuries, but it was not a significant increase in cost of healthcare utilisation, and they were mostly minor. This is just a graph depicting the difference. Again, there was a significant difference. The NNT at 12 months is about 7, and NNT at 24 months is about 14. So we made some improvements, but not a lot. Again, we did a cost-effectiveness analysis, and because it was delivered by nurses, it was a little cheaper because we factored in health professional time, but you can see in the first trial the cost of moving one person from inactive to active was there. We've done a systematic review. This is a euro equivalence in 2008, and on the second trial, depending on whether you do a 12 or a 24 month, it's still good compared with other interventions around the world that are based in primary care that have had cost effectiveness studies done. But really, cost-effectiveness studies like that aren't going to influence any policymakers. They want to see cost utility. And what I mean by that is cost per quality, or quality-adjusted life year. Now, a quality-adjusted life year is an international standard measure that takes into account the impact a pharmaceutical or other medical intervention has on quality as well as quantity of life. So in other words, they look at the life years saved, but also they adjust it for the quality of life improvements over time. It's based on economic analyses from randomized controlled trials. So you need randomized controlled trials to work out a cost per quality. Ideally, you need outcomes like death to work it out. A lot of interventions don't have death, so they extrapolate from the health benefit that they get to what the expected improvement in health outcomes will be, and then calculate their quality per, cost per quality. Now, the health funders or health funders use this as one of the criteria to decide what interventions, what pharmaceuticals are funded and what aren't. They don't like to tell you thresholds because that ties them to those, and it's not the only criteria. But as a rule of thumb, around less than, these are Canadian dollars I'm talking about now, less than $20,000 per quality is considered very good value for money. And most interventions that are funded are in that group or roundabout. Over $100,000 per quality is considered very poor value for money. So this is, again, Canadian dollars 2008 equivalent. So modelling, I'm not a health economist, but I work with a couple of health economists who did the modelling based on the cost effectiveness and the randomised controlled trial and the improvements in quality of life. We assumed that everybody who increased their physical activity went back to no activity by 4 years. So it was really just a small increase in physical activity and quality of life and health benefit. And it was then they modelled how much quality-adjusted life year benefit there would be compared with not. And they worked out a $1,600 per quality. 90% of iterations and assumptions meant that it would be somewhere between $600 and $30,000 per quality, which is mostly very good value for money. If we compare that with some pharmaceuticals, again, I use the example of statins. The cost per quality is around $16,000 to $27,000 in people who have already had a heart attack. It's around $16,000 to $76,000 in those who haven't yet had a heart attack but are at high risk. So quite comparable. In fact, the green prescription came out better, but statins do have more trials and harder outcomes. So what about compared with other community-based or primary care physical activity interventions? Not all of them are cost-effective. In fact, this is us here, our cost utility. This is, again, 2008 euro equivalents. But you can see up here, these ones up here, are exercise referral schemes. And they are not cost-effective. This 80,000 is around, is more than 100,000 Canadian dollars. They're not cost-effective in terms of comparing pharmaceuticals. So you will see some reviews that say physical activity promotion in primary care is not cost-effective. It depends on how you do it. If you refer to expensive gyms with close supervision and supervisors with low long-term adherence, then it's not going to be cost-effective. So you have to have an intervention that works well or is very cost-effective. So how is our cost utility analyses affected policy and affected government funding? I'm using the example of New Zealand. This is about the time of our first trial. And just comparing with cardiovascular medications. We know physical activity has more benefit than cardiovascular, but just looking at the comparison. So they spent a total of $64 million during 2003 on cardiovascular medications, and they spent $825,000 on the green prescription. Remember, similar cost effectiveness. But the pharmaceutical company, or arm of our government, Pharmac, agreed to fund the green prescription, which was good of them, after the cost utility. They did another cost utility on the basis and came up with similar results. So they funded it. Over the years, it increased until it was capped at 30,000 people receiving the green prescription through family practice in the year 2009. And it stayed about that even though the demand is higher. And you can imagine if 45% of our population would qualify, it could be quite a big intervention. So now where are we? The latest figures, over $700 million are spent on drugs, of which $53 million are spent on statins alone per year. More than $120 million on cardiovascular drugs, and the green prescription program is capped, which is the only physical activity program in primary care in New Zealand, is capped at $4 million a year. Exercise cardiac rehabilitation, I did try and find the figures, and I found a figure from a 2009 report, $2.8 million. It's just as effective as a statin, if not more. I tried to find the Canadian figures. In 2011, $32 billion was spent on drugs, but you've got 32 million people. We've only got four, of which $4 billion was spent on statins alone. I couldn't find any statistics on cardiac rehabilitation or exercise on prescription. I asked Rob Petrella, who is the leading exercise on prescription researcher in Canada, who's done a lot of research in that area. He didn't know. So we do know, though, from some of his figures, that only about 16% of family physicians, well, this was a 2007 survey, use exercise scripts in Canada, and less than half of patients ever recall their doctor advising physical activity for anything, even though most of us will say, yes, yes, of course, we advise often. So, and yet, 3 to 4 million people in Canada are on statins. So, exercise cardiac rehabilitation in Canada, the rates are about 20% of those who have an MI, but we know it halves the risk of a subsequent MI. Pretty much better than anything else, any other pharmaceutical intervention. It's in the UK, it's 30%, in Australia, 20 to 30%, the target is 70%. But the funding, I looked for funding everywhere, couldn't find it. I did find one example from Ontario where there was a quote that there are about 55,000 MIs or heart attacks per year in Ontario. There are only 18,000 places for exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation. There's underfunding, but there's also under-referral. Grace, I think Dr. Grace from the Canadian Association of Cardiac Rehabilitation said it's not only underfunding, it's under-referral. Health officials not referring. In New Zealand, it's even worse, 17%. The US also a very low rate of cardiac rehabilitation, yet we know it's so effective. So why is this happening? Why is there not prioritisation of physical activity interventions in healthcare settings? Is it because the research isn't done? Maybe we haven't got hard enough outcomes. For some areas like cardiac rehabilitation, we have got hard outcomes. But we haven't got the sort of body of research and hard outcomes that pharmaceutical products do have. Most of pharmaceutical trials are partly, if not all, funded by the pharmaceutical industry. So there are big backers, there is big money. There is not a lot of money for physical activity research or physical activity trials or cost effectiveness or cost utility studies. So it's very hard to produce big hard outcome research to lobby. However, we have managed some. Statins, the latest meta-analysis, one of the recent meta-analyses, there are 170,000 participants followed for at least 2 years from 26 randomized controlled trials. Blood pressure lowering medication in a recent meta-analysis, 464,000 participants from over 150 randomized controlled trials to show that these interventions reduce outcomes and are cost effective. Exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation, just over 6,000 participants from 34 trials, and yet it did still show reduction in events. Exercise to lower blood pressure in a meta-analysis, 2,500 participants. You're not going to show a reduction in events, particularly in a high risk but without previous events. You're not going to show events in that size population. And these are mostly short trials. We need a lot more exercise intervention research in healthcare settings to lobby perhaps more strongly. But there is evidence there already. So one example of some exercise that's being undertaken here in the Department of Family Practice led by Martin and Diana's and Christine, yes, there's a few of us. It's called FLIP, Facilitated Lifestyle Intervention Prescriptions. Now, this is bringing together some of the ideas from the green prescription, brief intervention in family practice with facilitators, community-based as follow-up, but also from the DPP and the other big diabetes prevention trials that shows that lifestyle interventions can reduce the progression to diabetes. So it's in people with pre-diabetes or at risk of diabetes, and it uses a prescription completed by the patient and family physician together, again using motivational interviewing. It's signed by the patient and physician as a contract, and it's sent to the exercise facilitator based in the community. So the trial, this is a pilot trial with CIHR funding, and it's to get 150 people from six practices cluster randomised. It's a pilot to go on to a bigger trial. The telephone follow-up is over 6 months, monthly follow-up, and follow-up will be done at 6 months. So I know we've recruited about 30 to 40 people, and they've been assessed, so we're well underway. It only started about 6 weeks ago. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that'll be good too. So, I mean, there are examples. There's Robert Petrella's trial, snack trial's just finished. It's got some similarities to this, and he's done a number of trials around the exercise intervention and exercise prescription in primary care. So just to conclude, I think we've discussed what we mean by global pandemic of physical inactivity, a little bit about the health benefits of physical activity, public health initiatives and international and regional recommendations for increasing physical activity across populations, and then honing down to how we address it with our patients in healthcare settings, which is complementary to policy level. And I think once that environmental changes happen, I think it will be easier to prescribe exercise and fewer barriers. We've talked about the effectiveness and cost effectiveness and the favourable cost utility of some exercise-based interventions in healthcare settings. We need more research, and it may be that we need to improve the way we prioritise our efforts and our fundings at the individual, community and national level, and perhaps lobby our government with current evidence to help address the pandemic of physical inactivity. So thank you very much. And are there any questions or comments?
Yes. Is that synergistic with exercise, like both decrease in mind by under 50% if take two decrease further? Are they working by the same way or a different way?
Well, Neil might be able to help us with that. He's the expert here. But I think some of these trials were done in treated populations. So in other words, this is after they've been treated. So it's quite likely that it is. And I'm not anti-pharmaceutical. I've actually just finished leading a trial of a polypill for cardiovascular prevention. And we know that pharmaceutical interventions for cardiovascular disease are synergistic and complementary. And you get a 25% reduced risk with statin, a 25% reduced risk with blood pressure lowering, and 20% reduced risk with aspirin. And I suspect, but I don't think the trials have been done, show that you probably reduce it at another 25% if you use an exercise-based cardiac rehabilitation program. These are high risk or people who've already had an event. Yeah, but and on the general population, I would imagine. So, but the research probably needs to be done. Yeah. Heather.
Australia, closer to your home, and part of the problem identified in conversations like this was the medical school training and the lack of this being a part of the curriculum, which seems to be the root of this problem. And in fact, anybody who had any sort of influence was challenged to make change at that level. What are your thoughts about that, and how do you go about introducing physical activity as important as any sort of pharmaceutical or pharmacological training?
Yeah, that's a very good point, and I teach undergraduates at med school myself. I mean, I think we are trying to introduce it, you know, piecemeal, but there's certainly no policy that I know about to make it a central topic. We do, more and more, we're bringing in lifestyle interventions into our teaching, but that's in family practice teaching, I'm not sure, and basic medical training, and I think that's another area for possible advocacy. Good point. I don't think it's the only problem, though. I think there are other issues as well. But we do need to raise the awareness of medical students and practitioners about the importance and the potential of these sort of interventions.
If there's not another question, can I ask for
me? Sure. Yes.
So then what would the barriers be to family physicians prescribing exercise or using the green prescription pattern within the practice? So, and part of it in my mind is training and them not feeling comfortable in doing so. But what are your thoughts? Are there must be evidence to support it?
Well, I think you're right. I think it's not prioritised at med school for a start. It's not prioritised in their continuing medical education either. But I do remember there was one study done way back in the late 90s looking at physical activity counselling or advice in primary care and family practice. And they found that if the family physician was active themselves, they were 3 times more likely to counsel or to advise physical activity. And for nurses, it was 5 times as likely. So I was thinking the most efficient way to improve advising exercises to make our health professionals active. Yeah, but I think also I think they're prioritising in the funding. I mean, a green prescription program. I know the national facilitator very well, Diana O'Neill, and she tells me there is a big need. There's a big demand, and they just have to cap it because there's not the funding. So, I mean, I think it's got to come from funding and policy level and prioritising at every level. But we don't have the industry backing that pharmaceuticals have. We don't have anyone who's going to make a lot of money from prescribing exercise. So I don't know if we're ever going to get the sort of traction, the marketing and the lobbying and the research funding and the policy influence that the pharmaceutical industry has. Yes?
Is there any evidence as to what kind of advice should be given in acute care settings? So we talk kind of like, obviously, the GP setting being where you've come from, but if you had doctors and physios and nurses in acute care, is there any kind of research done about if they start to advise on patients pre-discharge, if that makes sense?
Yes. Yes, well, I think that, I mean, it's not an area I'm particularly familiar with, but I know that in terms of rehabilitation and some of the chronic conditions, it's very important, you know, around stroke and even coronary, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. There's a lot of trials around exercise and improved quality of life, etc. In terms of the acute setting, like ED, emergency department, I know Megan's done a trial of the Otago exercise program for an older person who's fallen for falls prevention. So it was delivered in the acute setting, wasn't it?
The individuals were enrolled from the emergency department, but it wasn't delivered.
Right, initiated, I should say, from the acute, very acute setting. So I think it's absolutely possible. Yes?
Hi, thank you for your presentation. One thing I want to say is, what do you think about the relationship between exercise professionals and exercise itself? Because you did say a lot of general physicians being in practice, and nurses also offering the exercise recommendation and such, but where do you see the role of exercise physiologists, the ones who are start by here, and according to the CSN, you know, exercise specialists, what kind of role do you see them playing?
Well, I think they're really important, and I think this is where intersectorial comes in as well, because we are not experts in exercise advice and tailoring programs to people that are appropriate. I mean, there's obviously a lot of evidence out there about what sort of training program, how much resistance, how much aerobic, what's good for particular joints, etc. So there is a lot of a lot of knowledge that we could get from them, and I don't think we can expect family physicians to have all that knowledge themselves, so we need to work collaboratively. And I see that sort of expertise coming in more through the exercise facilitator. If the primary care or the family physician can write the exercise prescription to start the goals, and they have more expertise in terms of the support or tailoring the individual activity, I think that could work collaboratively. I'm sure there's lots of other ways as well. And maybe they need to come into the medical schools and teach the med students a bit more as well. But yeah, I mean, very important. Yes?
What about children? There is an epidemic of obesity in children now. Do you know of any program of intervention like this in children?
Yes, I probably have only really talked about adults in this talk, primarily. There is a whole other field in children. And yes, I do know of various interventions. We've had family-based interventions based a bit around the green prescription tried in New Zealand. It wasn't particularly successful. I know there was a recent book about interventions on children, looking at things that worked and things that didn't work. There are a raft of exercise programs. Heather's probably got some examples as well.
There's just a host of systematic reviews that look at sort of best practice related to children's physical activity and health, and some of them have obesity or healthy weight as an outcome. And the consensus across many systematic reviews is that a multi-pronged approach within schools, primarily was only effective with elementary school students, but not with teenagers. But so within schools, outside of schools, and using and before school, so multi-pronged approach, and not just physical education, and not just classroom-based, and not just sort of preschool-based, but everywhere was supposed to be.
So I'm sure Raina will be around for a few minutes longer, but I'd like formally just to thank her for an amazing tour of activity in adults and the benefits and the things that we can do to help them. So thank you very much indeed.